Hey everybody, and welcome back to From Complex to Queens, Amazing Avenues Minor League Podcast. I'm Steve Sipa, and I'm joined this week by Dr. Lucas Vlahos, and Mr. and Mrs. Ken Lavin, and Mr. Loser, along with myself, Thomas Anderson.
Ouch. So harsh.
Unless you're not a loser anymore, Thomas.
No, the only non-loser thing, well, I guess this is a loser thing, but I'm almost done with Final Fantasy VII Remake again, so.
Nice. All right,
that's an accomplishment.
So, yeah, the most accomplished of the three of us, clearly.
Thomas, I just
have the last chapter left.
I was playing a game that I believe is among your favorites in Disco Elysium, and
yes.
Was finding it a bit slow, honestly, and have just hit a point where I'm suddenly, like, completely invested.
Yeah, it's one of those things because there's, like, no combat or anything. You just kind of talk, I guess. I don't know how to describe
yeah.
it.
But yeah.
It took me a while to get in because I was mm-hmm. like, oh, yeah, okay. And then once you, like you said, once you get to a point, you're like, oh, I get it. Like, I get what I'm trying to do here.
I feel like I'm cracking the main case open and now I'm seeing some.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was kind of like pushing myself through because I know everyone says this game is incredible. I'm like, yeah, okay, I should experience this. And I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, this makes sense.
Yeah. And then Amazon is making a TV series about it, which is hilarious.
I have zero interest.
Of all the people to make a game, to make a TV series about that, it's Amazon.
Well, this seems like a terrible game to make into it.
Yeah, it's going to be boring.
Yeah, not great.
But yes, just the reason rules.
Mm. All right. So we'll start off this week by promoting Send Trade. And on this date, this is actually kind of interesting one, I think. On this date, January 22nd, in 1857, the National Association of Baseball Players held a convention, and it was basically the very first winter meetings. And they established a committee to make revisions to the original Knickerbocker rules of baseball and codified basically like the modern rule set. So which of these original Knickerbocker baseball rules would you promote, extend, or trade?
This should be good.
I guess, you know, promote, extend, trade, I guess would be like you want to bring back, you kind of are like, lukewarm about, and then definitely hate, I guess. So the first one we have, revision number 2, which gives specific dimensions to the bat that batters use, as opposed to the prior Knickerbocker rules, which didn't and allowed hitters to use round bats or flat bats.
I don't think I care.
Yeah, I don't think
a flat bat, I think, is significantly harder, easier to hit with.
I think it's easier like to make it's easier to make contact with, but the ball doesn't go as far.
Maybe
it'd be more like a cricket.
Yeah.
Could you imagine if like each batter did it based on their strength? So like McNeil is using a cricket bat, but
McNeil's using like a fucking tennis bat. Racket.
And everyone's hitting like 460 with this dumb bat, and they're slugging 460 because everything's a cheap single.
Be entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
It would be.
Next, we have revision number 5, which gives a specific location for the pitcher to pitch from, as opposed to the Knickerbocker rules, which didn't specify where the pitcher had to throw from. They just said that they had to be a line behind the line that was 45 feet from home plate, which is generally in the vicinity of where the pitcher's mound is, but mm-hmm. didn't specify angles and such. And last, we have revision 27, which stated that in all matches, 9 players from each club must constitute a full field, and they must have been regular members of the club for which they represent for 30 days prior to the match. No change or substitution shall be made in the game once it has commenced, unless injury or illness. Prior to that, people that weren't even part of the club or people that weren't even part of the team were allowed to join in games in order to field full teams, which is why if you go back in baseball reference to like the early 1800s or mid 1800s, I should say, you'll have a whole shit ton of random guys that have played like one game and there's literally no information about them. And there'll be names like Hat or Straw or Beer and things like that.
Some nature. Dude's cousin.
Yep.
Just like, hey, I know you're in town. Can you come play this game? We only have 8. Like, all right. Do you have a flat bat that I could use?
I think that one, I might promote that one because it's almost like the idea of having a normal ass dude in every Olympic event so that people can get a perspective on, because you know there's always some jambroni sitting on a jambroni. Is that a word?
Jambroni.
For a jambroni. I'm a jambroni.
Mr. Bongioni.
Anyway, there's always some jabroni sitting on their couch saying, man, I could run that fast. And like, no, you can't. I want to see one of these idiots saying, I could hit that fastball. No, you couldn't. So that could be educational, if nothing else.
It also reminds me of the emergency goalie in hockey. Which,
yeah,
those guys are like D2 athletes probably and played. It's not like literally a random guy, but still, the talent level between those guys and the actual NHL players is so vast that it would be fun to see that in a baseball setting.
I really appreciate how
an emergency catcher, some dude who went D3,
that'd be a disaster. I've always appreciated how much the NHL players get into it. Like, they always are so happy for the emergency goalie to get in the game, it seems like, after the fact.
Like, yeah, obviously, they want their starter. Like, a lot of times, those guys are, like, they're around. Mm-hmm. Like, they'll go to practices and stuff to, like, hang out with the team, and sometimes they even work for the team. So they're, like, friendly with the guy, too, so it's pretty cool. You could do that for baseball. Have some dude who went D2. Who is also like your assistant social media manager, and you're like, well, grab a glove because 3 people pulled their hamstrings.
Right. Imagine, you know, it's a 20 inning game or something like that. The bullpen is run out of bullpen arms, and you're just like, well, 50 Cent through the first pitch, get him in the boat D.
Oh no.
Like, the possibilities are, you know.
This is so topical because I saw a tweet earlier today that said it was making the joke, like, who cares about first pitches? I want celebrities to do the last pitch of the game. Bases loaded, 2 out, here's Danny DeVito. Coming out of the bullpen to Narco.
It's the World Series. Danny DeVito's popping out to finish it off.
Danny DeVito out of the Philadelphia bullpen to the Always Sunny theme.
That's the one that I'm extending because it's just all these amazing possibilities. You want to bring more fans back to baseball? I think that's a good way.
Put them on the field.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's at least one additional fan at every game because they're playing in it. The pitching one is also fun, I think. Like the bat one, I think, is whatever. But the pitching one, you could get some really crazy stuff like weird angles and have Rick Ankiel pitching from center field because that's the only place you can throw a strike from or whatever. could have a good time with that. I can't say I care about the bat.
Yeah, I think the bat's the clear worst one just because it's the most boring, I think. Yeah. Pitching from here's a line in the middle of the diamonds, just be anywhere else would be very funny. And
fuck also, your shift rules.
Could you imagine how hard these dudes would throw?
Like, it'd be absurd.
Like, if you give them a run-up, like, cricket, too? Because I would assume that if there's no mound, that doesn't they mean it means they don't have to be stationary on it. It's you could run up to the line.
That, I think that was addressed, and it might have been a problem, because about, like, 20 years later, they did add a minimum and maximum line that the pitchers had to be within, so...
Is it weird that I'm imagining this like a bunch of kindergartners arguing about the kickball rules at recess, and that's basically
precisely what this is.
Yeah.
You can't roll the ball from there. That's not fair.
It's funny you bring up kickball because there was, in addition to these Knickerbocker rules, there's also like other regional rules. And one of the regional rules was the Massachusetts rules. And apparently the biggest difference between those rules and the Knickerbocker rules is that a batter would be counted out. Basically, you could peg the batter with the baseball and he would be considered out, which is pretty awesome.
Who is that? There's like a clip of someone doing that in the playoffs, like spiking a guy down the first baseline because he was pissed off. Whatever.
I mean, it happens like accidentally a bunch of times. Mm-hmm.
But also, could you imagine if you move from like Boston to New York and then you just go to play in your local baseball league and you just beam some dude in the head with a ball? And
he's like, what the fuck?
And everyone's like, what are you doing? And he's like, what do you mean? What am I doing?
He's out.
Get him out of here. It's like, no, you go home. Get out of here.
That man is being carried off the field on a stretcher.
It's also funny to think about how, and I do it too, how we're like so into rule changes now. We're like, oh, you can't change the sanctity of, like, this was baseball 200 years ago or whatever. Obviously the math is off there, but like they used to have a line in the middle of a diamond that you could go on and you could hit people with the ball. Like the game changes, like it changes more than you think and more than we realize.
The game started as like funky cricket.
Yeah, exactly. And it evolved because that's what happens. It's just funny to think that. But there was some dude back then who was like, they're not going to hit people with the ball anymore between first and second. I'm done. I'm not watching.
Back in my day, batters could field runners got hit with balls all the time. These players are soft.
Soft. Back in my day, you played second base with your bare hands.
Like a real man.
They also went to work in the mines for like 12 hours after that. So.
Yeah, that's then, true. For sure.
Gotta let out some steam after the after in the mines for 12 hours, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So we have an email. It's not specifically about minor league baseball, but it was addressed to me, so we will discuss it here. It's from Larry, so it's kind of long-winded. I'll read the entire thing, and then you know we'll distill it down at the end. But Larry had a basic question about the Mets fandom in the Steve Cohen era. Is there something something unpleasantly embarrassing about being a fan of a team that just goes out and scoops up all the best players? Does it detract from the fan experience? I always looked with contempt upon Yankees for their profligate ways. I preferred rooting for a team that faced real constraints in team building and had to make the most of assets it accumulated. And it was always most gratifying when those assets were homegrown, or at least obtained via trade rather than free agency spending. The Yanks seemed like that rich, spoiled kid on the block who simply bought access to all the best equipment, venues, and professional lessons instead of meeting the rest of us scrappy make-do kids on the level playing field. And now, aren't the Mets turning into that spoiled rich kid? It's great that there's now real intelligence being shown in the Mets front office moves. I have no longing to return to the days of being a cheap and stupid franchise. But I'm sure I'm going to feel all great about Mets success if it feels like it's been basically purchased by Uncle Steve. And I wonder where there might be plenty more out there like me who might feel not exultant when the Mets stomp through the playoffs and instead when the Mets stomp through the playoffs, but instead sheepish and maybe a bit apologetic. Oh, okay, so instead of feeling exultant, you might feel a bit sheepish and apologetic. To me, it's more important how you win than that you win. I'm happier rooting for scrappy overachievers who provide lots of thrills, even if they don't quite reach the pinnacle, that I am for a championship team of purchased superstars, the best money can buy. Am I alone in this attitude? Might it be interesting for you guys to raise the issue? Thanks for listening, Larry. So basically, Larry's question is boiled down to, should we be happy that Steve Cohen can literally spend more money than the next five teams combined, and the Mets can just basically buy a playoff team?
I feel like I should not answer first on this one.
I'll go first, I guess. So I kind of feel like in the short term, I'm more than okay with it because none of the infrastructure to do the things that would be more satisfying, like developing players, etc. So in the short term, I'm you know, very okay with it. In the long term, I'd probably like a little more balance between like spending more than, you know, the GDP of some countries and you know, growing talent internally and, you know, looking for efficiencies.
Yep, that's very fair.
I think also most teams that are really good do have a balance. Like, yep. Like the we talk about the Moneyball A's and stuff, but they didn't win anything, and then they got really bad, and then here they are. And like the Rays are a better example, I think, but the Rays would be a perennial contender if they just spent a little money. You know, like they're already a perennial contender, but they would be like a perennial best team in baseball if they had like a mediocre salary cap, or not salary cap, payroll. So like the really good teams do both. Like the Astros are lauded as this team that has all this homegrown talent, but they also spend money. They don't spend crazy money, but they have a top 10 payroll. The Braves have a top 10 payroll. The Phillies had a top 5, I think. And they also have homegrown talent. You do both. Like that's how the good teams get really good.
Like the thing that we've all been saying,
the Dodgers.
The Dodgers East mentality.
Yeah, I think Dodgers that's my East. Idea. Yeah, but they spend $200 million dollars
anyway. Spend money on elite talent because, again, probably I've probably said this 35 times, but my biggest pet peeve with the game today is that, you know, spending isn't seen as a good thing. When in reality, like if you spend on, you know, accumulating like roll 8 and roll 7 regulars at each position,
organization in the world, it's I don't care how good you are. The Dodgers are not getting 9 stars from their farm system. It's just not
exactly right.
Like you could get being 5, able,
you know, when you have an opportunity to get Mookie Betts, you know,
yeah, you do
being
it anyway,
able to do that, right? Because he's an 8, and there's only so many 8s in the game, and the more of them you have, you know, wins are a zero sum game.
And like we're talking about this, and the Dodgers are now much worse off by letting Turner walk and having Gavin Lux play short or whatever he's going to do. Like he's a worse player, and they should have just signed Turner again, like re-signed him or extended him because they never signed. You know what I mean? Like. Sometimes there's negatives to that too, where you get worse, and the Dodgers are worse now than they were last year. It's just, it is what it is. And like, I don't know. It's always funny because we talk about this in baseball, but could you imagine like basketball teams build from within and all that stuff, and then they spend in free agency to help it. And football teams do that too. You get really good through the draft, but then you have to go out and spend up to the cap in free agency to help that because there's no way to get a full roster of players through the draft or through your farm system. It's just not possible. And so like the Mets are going to spend money. They're never going to, they won't do this all the time. And they didn't really do this time because they didn't sign Correa. Like they won't do this all the time because they'll be able to promote guys from the minors, but they don't have anyone.
Yeah. They're building the infrastructure to get there. So in the interim, I'm fine with them spending.
The two guys they have who you could look at and be like, those could be really plus regulars are Beatty and Alvarez. And Alvarez will be here in the middle of the season, and Beatty was a weird thing with Correa where he would have moved to left field, but now he has a very real chance of being the third baseman on opening day. So, but if the Mets didn't sign all the dudes that they signed, then they'd be bad next year. Like that's just the long and short of the situation right now, and it is what it is.
I mean, basically, my answer to this is that I'm not in favor of unilateral disarmament, right? I agree with the premise that a team that is homegrown is more rewarding. And I think the exercise of, at least the way I think the hardcore fans experience the game is better if there are actual constraints, because then it's an actual puzzle to figure out and not just spend more money. But that's not the way the system is currently set up. They do not have an ecosystem like basketball or football where basically everyone spends. And if you have the money, I'd rather they they use it. Now, I wish the system would improve to the point where this isn't how this wasn't a viable strategy, but right now it is, and it's really the Mets' only option at this point. So,
and like at least the Mets do actually have some homegrown guys to care about. like Pete is one of their biggest players, and they drafted him. McNeil, same thing. Nimmo, same thing. I know it's different, but Nito's on the bench, same thing. He's going to be here next year. Guillorme is a big part of their bench. He's going to be here. He's going to be here for a while. And Beatty and Alvarez are going to come up. So, like, it's not like the Mets are 26 mercenaries who are just out here doing their own thing. Like, they've drafted and developed players, and in 2015 they did it as well. And the 2015 window would have been a hell of a lot longer. The Wilpons spent more money in free agency to help the homegrown guys, and they didn't. And then look what happened. It fell apart within 2 years, because that's what happens if you don't spend money. There's just not enough. There's not enough young talent. It's just not possible.
All right. Well, we had two not very different perspectives, but, you know, we had a pro and a con there. So I hope that, was a good, I think that was a good,
overview. I certainly understand his reservations, but I don't think I'm anywhere near going to be like not crying myself with joy if the Mets win a World Series.
Let's get the first one and we can reassess from there.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. And I mean, the Yankees spent a lot of money too, but it's not like they didn't always have good farm systems. And they didn't always have not good farm systems, but they always had homegrown players and players that they always circumvent. They always helped. It was fine. Like in the 2000s, during their dynasty years, they had Jeter and all those guys who they drafted and developed. And they also got whoever they wanted because they were the Yankees. Like, you do both. And doing both is the way you win.
Mm-hmm. All right. I'm going to just quickly, well, maybe not quickly, we can go into it a little bit, but we're just going to finish up our January 5th international free agent discussion that we were having last week. The Mets ended up signing 28 named players, and then they also still have the rest of the year basically to sign other guys if they pop up. Catcher Davison Gutierrez, he was the highest bonus that the team gave out. He got $1.9 million. Shortstop Christopher Larez, he got the second most, $1.4 million. And outfielder Anthony Baptiste got the third most, $1.1 million. Those three guys alone account for basically $4.5 million of the roughly $5.3 million that the Mets had in their pool. So that remaining $800,000, more or less, is split between all those other players that were named. With the exception of anybody that signs for $10,000 or less, those deals don't count. And of course, the team, you know, if they want to, they can trade for more money if anybody else kind of pops up over the course of the year, which does happen periodically. So the other day, I was talking to friends of the podcast, Leah Murphy, and we were talking about Baptist. And I'm going to read the MLB.com blurb that they wrote up for him on the 2023 international prospect rankings.
Oh no.
It's funny. He told me too.
Like I didn't really like until we were talking.
I didn't
like,
realize either.
Yeah. Yeah. But quote, he's expected to start in center field and stay at the position as he develops primarily because of his speed, but also because he has the potential to be an above average defender. He could chase balls down in the outfield, and like prospects his age, he's working on fine tuning his roots and angles. The hope is that his speed, he's consistently being clocked at 6.1 seconds in the 60-yard time run, will also come into play on the bases, and he can develop into a base dealer in the future. When you consider his emerging bat-to-ball skills and overall athleticism, he could slide in near the top of the lineup. End quote. So we just last week that the guy is really, really fast. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he is very, very fast. Now, here's the thing. A 6.1 in the 60-yard dash would make him faster than American 9-time Olympic gold medalist Carl Lewis. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And many, many, many other Olympians.
I didn't realize how fast it was because he did the same to me, too. And yeah. I was like, oh, that's that fast? Because I have no frame of reference for that. and he was a track guy. I know he ran track, so he knows all this stuff. But I was like, goddamn.
Press X to dash. Like what? Like sixth grade? I think sixth grade speed is something like a 6.7 in the or 6.8 in the 60-yard dash. Like that's 6 or 7 grade speed. This dude's running a 6.1.
Yeah, I mean, yeah,
like he's like just teach him to bunt and it's over. Teach him to bunt and he'll hit 600 because he's just faster than he's just too fast.
There is a non-zero chance that he is one of the fastest men in the world. I mean, you never know.
Have you seen him run?
But yeah, you know, basically everybody is just running with the quotes from the trainers and probably the team and, you know, not cutting through the bullshit. And, you know, it's not those media people's jobs to like look everything with a fine tooth comb and a microscope and be like, hey, he's not really wanting a 6.1 in the 60-yard dash, you know. But it is something that, you know, everyone should be aware of when, you know, you're reading about these players, you know, especially the IFAs, because there's just really so little information about them. But also even with high school kids, you know, I mean, look at Simeon Woods Richardson a couple of years ago when the Mets drafted him. Everyone was saying like, oh my God, this guy throws, you know, 98 miles an hour. At no point in time can I find conclusive evidence that he ever threw 98 miles an hour. When I saw him in person, he was throwing like 92. The highest reports I was able to find from like high school, you know, newspapers, you know, about his high school days was like 94, 95, something like that. So, you know, all this kind of stuff, this kind of reporting, you know, big fish kind of reporting is just something that you always need to be aware of. You know, everybody has the potential for Barry Bonds' power, and all these kids have the potential to have Ted Williams' batting eye, and Greg Maddux's control, and Sandy Koufax's curveball, and blah, 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 you know. But, you know, in reality, all these kids are good comparative to, like, other kids in their age range. You know, when a kid has plus power, you know, he's not going to be going to Citi Field and hitting them over the wall. He's shows good power comparative to other 15-year-old kids, 16-year-old kids. When he has good control as a pitcher, as a high school student, it's relative to other high school students, not, you know, a major league pitcher. So it's all relative and things you need to just be aware of.
Yeah, like Baptiste is fast. It's not like he's going to go out and be slow and everyone's going to see that they're lying. But a 6-1 in the 60 would be like the fastest player in the league times 10.
So he's hoping that he actually is the fastest player in the league times 10.
Trying to find Billy Hamilton's 60-yard dash if I can. Billy Hamilton was clocked at 60. Here's an article from Cincinnati ABC Channel 9 WCPO. Let's just hope this is reputable. Hamilton was clocked at 60 yards by the Reds before he was drafted. He ran it in 6.2.
Mm.
So if he's Billy Hamilton fast, sure.
But it seems unlikely.
How many players have we seen like that, you know? That would be like a unicorn trait to be that fast.
All right, so we are going to be continuing now our top prospect countdown discussion for the 2023 list. Last week, we reviewed prospects 20 to 16, shortstop Jesus Baez, and then I didn't even realize this when we were doing it, but right-handers Bryce Mantisto-Oca, right-hander Leonel Ovias, right-hander Jose Budo, right-hander Matthew Allen. And now starting us off this week is another right-hander. Right-hander Joel Diaz. And Diaz was signed as an international free agent out of the DR in 2021. And his debut was phenomenal. He had a 0.54 ERA in 50.1 innings in the DSL with 21 hits allowed, 9 walks, and 63 strikeouts. And that was really, really, really good, and he had a ton of helium coming into the season. but, you know, numbers in the DSL don't really matter. And he was not able to post a 0.54 ERA this past season in the Florida State League, St. Lucie.
Failure. Didn't you, your ERA wasn't literally one run every 18 innings.
His ERA was basically like basic math here. Let's see. So it was basically 12 times higher, almost. It was a 5.86 ERA in comparable innings, 55.1. He did strike out a bunch of guys, though, which is good. He allowed a couple more hits and a couple more walks per inning. So, yeah. But also keep in mind that, you know, despite a 5.86 ERA and despite allowing more than one hit per inning and the walk rate going up and everything, we did rank him 15 in our top prospect list. There's a ton to like about him. He's 18 and was pitching against hitters who were basically on average 4 years older than him. So, you know, treading water, being a little bit below league average, you know, that's still a feat in and of itself, you know. And the underlying stuff was pretty good. He has a good fastball. He has a good curveball. Flashes plus. Well, flashes above average. I wouldn't necessarily say plus, yeah. You know, good curveball. It's just, you know, with him, he's a young kid, you know, facing guys that are older, that have better eyes, and he just has to learn how to, you know, pitch against guys like that. He can't just overpower people like he did in DSL.
I'm a little worried.
Probably good learning experience.
Yeah. I'm a little worried. Like, he improved in the second half, which I think some people have pointed to as signs for encouragement. I'm a little worried that that came on the back of his changeup, because at that level, like, if you have a at all viable changeup, it just eats people alive because they've never seen one before. So I'm a little concerned about that.
Well, I mean, that's good. It shows that he has a minimum developing changeup.
Sure, but I feel like
I see where you're coming from.
Yeah, I feel like if your best secondary pitch is a change at this level, it can kind of make you look a little better than you are, perhaps. But
the Jose Budo question that we talked about.
Yeah, and I think Rafael Montero would fit into that conversation as well.
Ace closer, yeah, Rafael good Montero.
Now, but, yes, but well, it took him a decade and the Astros or Mariners, who actually taught him the slider, whoever, but long way to get there.
I would assume the Astros, because they did the exact same thing to Blake Taylor. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
It's one of those things where, as much as I don't want to overreact to the DSL numbers, I don't want to overreact to these numbers either. It's probably somewhere in the middle, and he's at least interesting enough to keep in the top 15 when the system is kind of like still in a transitional period, even though it's trending up.
Right. I mean, if he put up similar numbers that he did in the DSL this season, he would be like 5, right, not 15, you know? So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he'd be easily, and we'd be talking about him like, what is this, an 18-year-old phenom? But he was an 18-year-old kid moving to the States and had some growing pains. It's fine. I'm curious to see. He's one of those guys I'm very curious to see how he does this year, because he's a another year here, another year with facing these guys, like facing older players with a little better competition and stuff like that. So he's one to circle, I think.
We will watch his career with great interest. Next up on the list is third baseman Jacob Raymer. And he was selected last year in the draft. He was the Mets' fourth round pick. They selected him out of Yucaipa High School in California. And they signed him for $775,000, which is basically almost $250,000 over slot. And the Mets sent him to the complex, the FCL Mets. He appeared in 7 games, so it's not any kind of real it's not a sample size that you could really build anything off of. But he did hit 261, 414, 478 with one home run and six walks to three strikeouts. He's got a bit of pop, but he's kind of more contact oriented during games. It's batting practice power right now. He's just, you know, still young, still learning how to hit in game, put the barrel on the ball. So, you know, it's hopefully that power should develop in the future as he becomes older and more comfortable playing professionally and everything like that. He does have a good eye and he is kind of selective. I don't think that he's going to run a 414 OBP for his career.
Yeah. Don't smash my hopes and dreams, Steve. This is the type of profile I love to overrate.
Yeah, I know. Will Toffee 2.0.
I like him a lot too. He's better than that. Come on.
Will Toffee's bat speed was questionable, and then he like had a bad shoulder injury, and then it was gone. So hopefully it's not that.
No.
He's like, it's funny that we have him this high. He's higher on Baseball Prospectus's list. He was also higher on Baseball America's list, if I recall correctly. And we never even talked about their second round prep pick at all.
Well, oops. You know, it is what it is.
Yeah, I mean, they they whiffed real bad on one, but this looks like a nice little pick here.
Yeah, he's interesting. I mean,
when you talk about and he's a third baseman, and, you know, he should be able to stay at third base. I mean, he is 6'2", 205 pounds. So, I mean, even if he put on, you know, 20 pounds of muscle.
He'll be fine, yeah.
Yeah, that should be fine at third base. You know, when you think of a third baseman that potentially could hit for a decent batting average, has a bit of pop. You know, he's kind of athletic. I'm sure that Raymer could steal maybe 10, 15 bases a year. You know, as a Mets fan, it's hard not to think David Wright. Now, if Raymer had a fraction of David Wright's career, if anybody had a fraction of David Wright's career, that would be a major, major success, you know?
I think, pretty far and away the third most exciting third most exciting pick from the last draft. Even if he's not actually ranked the highest, like Tidwell is great, and we'll talk about him in a little bit, but I think Reimer has the most stuff you can dream on after Parada and Williams, at least for me. So I'm pretty excited to watch how this develops.
I think he has legitimately good upside.
Mm-hmm.
To have a good eye at his age and his experience level, like they took him out of high school and he got thrown into the majors, into professional baseball. And sure, it was literally seven games, so it doesn't really matter, but it's still nice to see that. And that was something that I remember when they drafted him, I was like, oh, the Mets never draft guys like this. The guys who they draft in this area of the draft are always some like boring overproducer in college who's not very good. And then they aren't good. And we're all like, wow, where did that go wrong? And this is like the opposite of that. This is a pick that a smarter team would have made. And then he has a chance to be like a regular player. And because there's more traits, there's a lot more things with him to dream on, like Lucas said. And I agree with that. I really like him, though. I'm a big Reimer fan.
Yeah, he is. I guess he's the most exciting position player prospect since Beatty.
Prep and, guy? I mean, yeah. We're not counting Williams, sure. Trying to figure out
recent memory.
Yeah.
I mean, it's also kind of not fair. I mean, Beatty was like a certified first round guy. Williams is a certified first round guy. You know, trying to think of, also the Mets just really have not drafted like prep kids in, you know, the middle couple of rounds. Like,
I mean, that's
what I'm saying. Like, yeah. Those guys that they drafted were so boring that it was so easy to just not care.
Is that the biggest takeaway from this? Is that they had an interesting middle round pick that wasn't a college reliever or something, which they've had to their credit the last couple of years, they have drafted a couple interesting older college arms, which we've talked about, but like they've not dipped into this sort of mid-tier prep bat market, and their first foray seems to have yielded something. Now we have a 30 plate appearance sample size, so who the hell knows? But
I'm gonna say off the top of my head now, the most interesting middle round prep guy that they've signed, I don't even remember his name anymore.
Was, well, that says a lot, doesn't it?
It was
a good start.
Yeah, 2017, Jack Schmidt was his name, the kid that got drafted, and he got basically into a single game and he got hit in the eye and then retired.
I have no memory of this. I gotta
be honest. I don't remember that either.
Really? Ken, can you help me out? Do you have recollection?
No, not at all.
Oh, come on. Jack was his name. Now I'm looking it up. I want to say 2017.
You know, real uncommon name, Jack. That'll really
Jack. Jack Schmidt. Jack. It was an SCH. All right, 2017. Jack Snyder.
That Jack sounds Snyder. Slightly more familiar.
He was drafted in the 11th round.
Okay.
So, I mean, that's a little bit, there's a little distance there between the 4th round that Raymer was and the 11th round. But, yes, he was drafted in the 11th round of the 2017 draft. He played in 3 games for the GCL Mets. He got hit in the face in his final, what would be, I guess, his final plate appearance, and retired from baseball.
I can't even say I blame him, honestly. Like,
yeah.
No, I don't need this.
Yeah, so the Mets don't draft too many prep position players.
Yeah, I think we said this at the draft, too, if I remember correctly. That once they made that pick, I was definitely saying to myself, this is something that they normally don't profile, they normally don't care about. And I think it's definitely evidence that we're moving in a new draft direction for the Mets, even though a lot of the guys are still there. I think it's very clear that they're doing other things because the Mets just don't draft these guys. And new regime, new owner, here we are, they drafted one of them. And not to say that he's going to be work out and be a star, but if you take this profile enough, they will work out. The players who you take here will end up being, some of them will pop, and then that's how you end up with like solid regulars from your system, and you don't have to spend $10 million on every position because you need to, otherwise you're going to be bad. Look, to go back to the question from before,
I'm not comping his skills to this player at all, but like the Mets signed a useful shorter third baseman in Eduardo Escobar, who is a nice little player. That's a reasonable deal. It would also be nice if you weren't paying $10 million a year for that profile. And if Reimer can do that, which I think is a, like, that'd be an excellent outcome for this pick. It's not like an insane outcome, I don't think.
We're not saying he's going to go be Evan Longoria or some good, but not amazing. You know what I mean? Like, if he's Eduardo Escobar, I'm signing up for that 1,000 times.
Yep. In 2027 or whatever. I don't know what year it would actually be.
Exactly.
If the planet still exists.
When Beatty is like, you know what, I'm just a DH, it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
That's when Reimer comes up and says, hello, don't worry about it.
All right. Next on our list is another player who, along with Jack Schneider, joined the team in 2017, if you could believe it. It seems like a million years ago, Stanley Consuegra. And he was an international free agent who signed to the Dominican Republic on the first day of eligibility back then, which is July 2nd. He signed for $500,000, which is a pretty decent sum. You know, that's definitely like, you know, if you figure like the top tier international free agents get millions of dollars, the second tier, $500,000, is a pretty nice sum. He started off his professional career with the Mets in 2018. They sent him stateside basically almost immediately, And he didn't dominate, but he held his own in the GCL as a 17-year-old, which is, you know, pretty good. You like to see it. He entered the 2019 season with a knee injury, and he had surgery on his ACL, so he missed the entire year. And then, of course, 2020, the season got canceled because of COVID, so he missed another entire year. And in 2021 now, in June, when the FCL season started, he was rostered on the team, but then he broke his hand after just a couple games, and he missed like 2 months, basically. So all in all, he had basically, coming into this season, like 20 games or so in the complex or below. You know, easy to write a guy off, like a guy off with that little experience, that much missed time. The Mets assigned him to St. Lucie this year, and he did not look like somebody that missed that much time. He hit 251, 324, 431 in 66 games with St. Lucie, with 8 homers, 8 stolen bases, and 26 walks to 77 strikeouts. And then he finished the season with Brooklyn. He was promoted at the beginning of July. And in Brooklyn, the performance took a little bit of a dip. He hit 239, 309, 381 with 5 homers, 4 stolen bases, and 18 walks to 62 strikeouts. So in 2022 in total, he hit 245, 317, 408 in 122 games with 13 homers, 12 stolen bases, and 44 walks to 139 strikeouts. That's a lot of strikeouts.
Yeah.
But ton of power. We only have, you know, information about certain players in certain leagues and obviously, you know, certain situations. But of all the players that played in St. Lucie, Consueger had the most power out of everybody. This guy averaged, what did he average? Okay, I didn't write down what he averaged. But basically, a third of all the balls he hit in play had exit velocities of 100 miles per hour or higher. That's how hard. Yeah. There was 171 recorded batted ball events, and 51 or 100 or higher.
I mean, that's particularly impressive because what teams supposedly like to look at is like 90th percentile exit velocities to say, like, not what's your peak, what's your average, but how hard do you like typically hit it when you hit it really well? Yeah. And he's above 100 if he has a third above 100. Like, that's really good.
That's a lot. Yeah, that's really good.
26 were above 105, and 8 were above 110, which is that's some above average power. Now, of course, the swing, you know, 139 strikeouts, he's literally swinging for the fences. So, you know, it comes with a cost. But at the same time, you know, he has been drawing a decent amount of walks, and he did, you know, miss literally like 2.5 years of baseball. And he is a young player from the DR. So, you know.
All I heard was Adam Dunn. Those are all the words that she said to me.
Adam Dunn, who can play a passable outfield.
Play outfield, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, hey, why not?
If that's what happened.
Adam Dunn was really good.
Yeah, I think Adam Dunn would be like
one of my personal cheese balls.
Yeah.
Adam Dunn had played arguably what makes baseball interesting is weird shit like that can lead to, you know,
hit the farthest home run I've seen at Citi Field, like over the fucking Shea Bridge one time. Like,
that dude could hit the baseball just like just
I gotta go
boy through and through.
I gotta go find that clip if I can. But he just routinely would park balls somewhere, be like, okay, man, that's not normal.
I don't think Consueger is going to draw the amount of walks that Dunn did because
Sure.
You know, Dunn is a 3 true outcome player. Maybe Consueger could be a 2 outcome player, but that's still, you know, that's still a player that has a role on a major league team. You know, maybe not as a regular, but when
I mean, if he could be a 4th outfielder who hits for power and has a little bit of an eye off the bench and can run and like play a passable outfield. So you don't have to pay Tommy Pham $6 million to do it.
Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. I don't think like that Stanley Consuegra is going to fight anybody. So
I have a
slight... Does he know Muay Thai?
Is he into fantasy football? I have a spicy Stanley Consuegra take. And I'm looking at the rankings I sent Steve, and I'm wondering why I didn't stick with this. I think Stanley Consuegra is closer to Alex Ramirez than we're giving him credit for.
Oh, absolutely.
I think people agree with that, and people don't want to hear that, but I don't disagree either.
I think Alex Ramirez is overrated, and I think Stanley Consuegra has more intriguing power, a less wonky swing. I wouldn't go so far as to like say I'd pref Consuegra over Ramirez, because I think that would just be wrong and kind of insane.
Yeah, I think that's going too far in the other direction.
But there, the gap between them. This is all to say I quite like Consuegra and think there's even potential for an actual starter in here down the line.
I will be completely honest.
No, yeah, I like him too.
I was very surprised that not everyone had him as high as I had him, and I had him in the top 10. I'm surprised that he did not end up in the top 10 in our collective rankings.
I don't understand why I dropped him down so far here. Like, yeah.
Maybe just health risk.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's part of it. And the strikeouts.
It's the strikeouts, and for me, the missed time, you still have to factor it in. It's not, I know it sucks for him, but it's stuff that actually happened to him. He missed a lot of time. And mm-hmm. It was nice to see him get back on the board, and I think if he has another strong season, he's easily top 10. And then we're talking about him maybe even playing in the majors kind of soon-ish, because he would probably start in AA, I would guess, and go from there. But, yeah.
Yeah, I think that is.
I had him 12, so I could have put. I think I should have put him 11. That's where I think I would have.
I don't know why I had him all the way down at 17. Like, what am I doing?
I had him at 12.
You know, you were busy with your doctor stuff. It's understandable. It happens.
I also think, I don't know how it is for you, but sometimes I'll find myself really bullish on someone and then be like, wait, I'm going too far, and then go too far in the other direction.
Yep, kinda, I think that might have been happened.
To kind of counterbalance it, to be like, no, I'm being crazy, this is too much, and then I drop him too far in the other direction, and then I feel silly about it.
I did have Reimer in my top 10, though.
All right, now, next up is another right-handed pitcher. Mets sure do have a lot of those. Mike Vasil.
They love him.
Yep. Mike Vasil was drafted in 2021. He was their eighth round pick, and they selected him out of the University of Virginia. Vasil is he's from New England. He's a Massachusetts guy, and he was kind of a pretty big high school prospect. Definitely, you know, a guy of interest and a guy to follow by all of the national scouting and evaluating group organizations coming into the 2018 draft, but he had a arm injury in his senior season, and basically he saw the writing on the wall, so he withdrew his name from consideration for the draft that year and committed and honored his commitment to the University of Virginia. And did he cost himself money? I don't know. You know, his tenure at the University of Virginia was not disastrous, but it wasn't, you know, like particularly great either. So when he did finally get drafted with the Mets in the eighth round, he got slot value, which was $181,000. Could he have made more than that if he said, screw it, I'm going to get drafted as a high schooler despite an arm issue? Possibly, maybe.
Could have made more than that if he went to a different college in all likelihood, because Virginia has a recent track record of just butchering arms.
Yeah, yeah, that is a that is.
That's a bold choice. My arm hurts. Let me go to Virginia.
They're going to develop me wrong and also probably get me hurt. Great. It's going to be great.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that the Mets did, like, almost immediately was change some of his mechanics and change some of his pitch usage. And, you know, when you're literally doing that immediately after getting drafted, maybe not the best program. But, yeah, he was drafted by the Mets, 2021, appeared in a couple of games, you know, but really his career started in earnest this past season. He was assigned to the St. Lucie Mets. He posted a 1.81 ERA in 35 innings over 8 games, allowed 23 hits, walked 11, and struck out 37, which is pretty good. He was promoted to Brooklyn at the end of May, along with, like, basically everybody else in the St. Lucie rotation. And coming to Brooklyn, normally pitchers do better because it's just a better environment for a pitcher. And that was not the case with Mike Vassell. Mm-hmm. He was doing very good in St. Lucie. Then he came to Brooklyn and he did very, very bad. He posted a 5.40 ERA in 28.1 innings over 6 games. He allowed 23 hits. He walked 12 and he struck out 39. And then he went on the disabled list with irritated bone spurs in his elbow. He came back at the end of the year. He made a couple of appearances and he did look a little bit better. And then the Mets sent him to the Arizona Fall League to log a couple more innings. And he was actually pretty good in the AFL. He had a 2.93 ERA in 15.1 innings with 10 hits allowed, 9 walks, and 18 strikeouts. He was basically the only guy that the Mets sent to the AFL this year that was halfway decent. But basically, Vassell's Achilles heel right now is just too many walks.
At least he's not at the Levi David level of walks.
Well, yes. I mean, oh, nobody. God,
yeah. That's like its own personal tier.
Yeah.
It's the God tier of...
You're bad, and then you're Levi David, you know.
I'm going to start calling players the prospects the Levi David of walking or whatever, like an offensive player. Like Jacob Raymer's the Levi David of taking pitches, you know?
Mm.
Just the best. The best at doing something. Mm-hmm. He's the best at walking people.
That's true. In the system, he definitely is. And of balks and of wild pitches as well. So he's a triple threat.
A three-outcome pitcher. The true three outcomes.
Pitching triple crown of terribleness.
Levi David out here catching strays. We weren't even talking.
Sorry, Levi. I actually like your stuff. Please find the strike zone.
I hope Levi David has a brother and he finds you on Twitter and he starts
No, no,
you.
Not again. Anthony K just got DFA'd by the Cubs. So, yeah.
Wait,
so,
did he really?
Yes.
For who?
What's his name? Mancini, right? I think.
Oh, okay. The Mets are gonna claim him real fast.
I don't have a problem with them That'd claiming him, but
Hey,
I actually don't either. But it'd be fun.
Yeah. But yeah, back to Mike Vassell. So yeah, his command is not great.
No bueno.
No, it's the stuff is pretty solid. The stuff is pretty solid. His fastball sits in the mid-90s. It averages 94. Above average spin, so gets a decent amount of strikeouts from that. And he has a, you know, wide variety of secondary pitches, and they're all considered average or better, slider, curveball, changeup. And you know, with him, it's just basically he has to harness his stuff and he has to throw everything in the strike zone. When the Mets drafted him, they basically said, we know that your coaches at Virginia had you throwing your two-seam fastball. Don't do that. We want you to throw your four-seam fastball. So he's, you know, he has responded, which is, you know, good. He's definitely has been better as a professional than he was in college. But, you know, the injury makes everything hard to kind of gauge because if he had come up from St. Lucie doing really good and continued doing really good in Brooklyn, you know, say there was no injury and then did pitch in the AFL really well, you know, we might have a very, maybe not a radically different view of him, but maybe we would think more highly of him.
Yeah. And also, like, to his credit, if he is restarting all this stuff from what the Mets are changing from Virginia, then there's a lot of work he's doing that is a lot different. There's a rebuilding the pitcher almost. And I feel like I'm a little harsh on Vassell because I like him the least out of Vassell, Ziegler, and Hamill. I think pretty significantly so. But also, to give him credit, there's a lot that they needed to fix because of Virginia, and he's been hurt and stuff like that. So not to say that he's the jury's out on him. There's no, just like, sorry, it's the same thing with Levi David. The jury's not out on you, my friends. But
oh, now you're friends.
No, you know what I mean. Like, at the end of the day, these guys are developmental, and development is not linear, and crazier things have happened. And that's not to say that it's crazy if Vassell ends up good. It's just, there's a lot of work that he needs to do, and I think I discounted how much work he actually needs to do.
And it's not like Vassell has like 20 grade control, and he's
just, exactly.
It's just, you know, slightly below average, you know, with more reps, with coaching, you know, all it takes is a simple thing, maybe, you know, move your leg up another inch when you push off the mound, you know, lean to the left instead of the right, whatever, you know, all it takes sometimes is just something stupid like that, and then the light bulb goes off. So
yeah,
it's definitely possible with Mike Vassell. And ending the discussion this week is another right-handed pitcher, Calvin Ziegler. And he's another guy the Mets selected in the 2021 draft. He was selected in the second round. He's a Canadian kid, and he basically moved to the U.S. during the pandemic to be able to keep pitching. He went to the TNXL Academy in Florida, and that's where he got drafted out of. And the Mets signed him for $910,000, which is, believe it or not, considerably below the MLB signed slot value. So he is basically our 11th top prospect, and he is an underslot savings pick, which kind of funny when you think about it. He didn't pitch at all that season, so they let him, you know, just get prepared to pitch this season. And he was impressive at times. He started off the season like insane. His first couple of games, he had a 3.10 ERA in 29 innings, which is decent, with 11 hits allowed, which is really good. 18 walks, which is not great. And 48 strikeouts, which is insanely good. But basically, after like the first 2 months of the season, he got bicep tendonitis, and his season basically just kind of derailed after that point. He got brought back on the active list, St. Lucie, made a couple more starts, got shut down again, was used in limited spurts from that point on. So basically, all in all, his first season as a professional, he had a 4.44 ERA in 46.2 innings, 26 hits allowed, and 70 strikeouts, which is pretty good. But when you consider how unbalanced everything was from first half to second half, not even half, you know, first couple of two, three months to the rest of the year, not great. Kind of makes it hard to gauge how he was, I guess, because you have the injury and just the results and the stuff, and everything was just so radically different, you know, pre-injury and then after injury. But when he was healthy, the stuff looked amazing. You know, fastball sits in the low to mid 90s, was very effective. You know, he has a flat vertical approach angle, which is the kind of in vogue thing right now. He has a very good curveball. He has a very solid changeup. And, you know, just the control is not great. When he's the kind of guy, like, when he misses, he really misses.
Really misses, yeah.
Yep. Yeah. But again, he is a prep pitcher, so those guys are some of the most inexperienced of all the professionals. And his, I don't want to say unique background, because, you know, it's not like Canada is like, you know, Nepal or anything like that, you know, but he has less experience than the average prep pitcher. So, you know, there's plenty of promise. We just need to get more reps and just kind of become more consistent in what he does.
Yeah, I mean, I think Ramirez has gotten a little bit more helium than Ziegler, especially in like the global lists, like the BA or BP lists, and they know more than I do, so I don't want to argue with them too much. I think they're slightly too high on him, but Ziegler might be the most overrated prospect among like Mets prospect Twitter. I don't know if that's fair to say or not. He's an okay righty prep pitcher who got hurt, which is significant. It's fine. There's a long way to go.
Yeah, I mean, he is a player that if the system was a little stronger, you know, this is, instead of being on the cusp of the top 10, this is the kind of guy that maybe would be like 15 to 20.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's the weakness of the system popping up. And I like Ziegler a little more than Lucas, but I genuinely agree anyway. Like, none of these guys should really be in this area. And if you really want to have what I'd consider a good system, they'd be in the middle of the teens. But also, that's not that far off. That's only a few prospects off.
Right.
It's not like Ziegler's three, and we're like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, then things
you know, and then we're talking about how there's no one around.
That would be the Royals.
Yeah, exactly. That's just not the case. Yeah.
For anyone who doesn't get that, the Royals have a really bad system right now.
They're going through it in case.
Well, good. They deserve it to the Royals. Screw them.
Yeah, I hate the Royals. Fuck the Royals, man.
Honest, and you know, Ziegler, he is what it is. He's fine. You know, he's a prospect that you want, you know, you want 50 prospects like this in the system because there's pretty decent upside and, you know, it is what it is. But if you just look at all of the guys that got drafted, like, around him, though, like, you could really see, like, damn, it really hurts. And this is, this is the 2021 draft. So this is the draft where they selected Kumar Rocker at the first round. They basically knew what they needed to do. They knew what his price was going to be. They, I guess, did not know what his medals were going to be. But
clearly not.
Yeah, clearly not. But, I mean, there's so much talent that was selected, you know, after Ziegler. And it's just like, damn. If the Mets had not been enticed by Rocker falling and had some extra money to spend, you know, in the second round, there's a shit ton of talent that they could have picked up.
Yeah, that was a weird draft anyway.
Yeah.
Just so like they put all their eggs in the Rocker basket and they didn't draft someone to protect it. We've gone over this a million times, but
I mean, it would be nice to have James Wood in the system.
Ugh.
Who got selected, you know, like 10 picks after.
Painful.
Yeah.
I can't even complain, though, because I didn't like James Wood. Because he couldn't make contact in high school. And I feel like 99 times out of 100, if you have contact issues against high school pitching, you don't usually figure that out. Turns out he figured it out. Now he's like the third best prospect in baseball. So,
well, he is definitely not an above average player. So don't worry.
No, we don't need to delve into that whole
shit show. I like that we all know exactly what's going on without even having to say. But yeah, Kelvin Ziegler, solid player, solid prospect to have, and just gonna want to see, you know, more from him next year, more good stuff next year. All right, so if anyone has any questions, comments, whatever, you could send us an email at our email address from complexthequeens@gmail.com. You could follow us on Twitter and shoot us questions there. I'm at Steve Saipa. Lucas is at ElvaHost343. Ken is at KenLavin91. And Thomas is at SadMetSeason, SZN. Subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcast from. Rate and review it. And of course, we thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week. So until then, love the Mets, love the Mets.